Good afternoon. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and this is the Healthy Options program on WERU Community Radio. As the weather has changed, it's time again for us to have a chat with Dr. Beatrice Santier about ticks, Lyme disease, and other tick-borne diseases, and importantly, how we can protect ourselves from tick encounters. For more than two decades, Dr. Santier has lectured on Lyme disease and related tick-borne disorders throughout Maine and nationally to both professional and community groups. She's an active member of the Vector-Borne Disease Workgroup for the Maine CDC, as well as a member of the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. Try 2022. Dr. Santier also had served on the Federal Tick-Borne Disease Working Group, Access to Care, and Education Subcommittee. Currently, Dr. Santier serves on the Education Committee for VectorWise CME, a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing clinical knowledge of vector-borne disease through free, fully accredited, online, evidence-based courses for frontline clinicians. Welcome back to Healthy Options, Dr. B. Santier. It's so good to speak with you again.
It's always good to be with you, Rhonda. Thank you.
So there's so much to catch up on. We have a whole new category. I think we've mentioned alpha-gal in the past, but now I could tell you at least two cases I know of in Maine. So we have to talk about that and where to start. Let's talk again about what a tick can carry, what a vector-borne disease means, and what we're up against in this world.
Well, ticks are active. As the temperatures rise above freezing, ticks in Maine become active and are looking for a blood meal. Ticks are, technically, they're arthropods. They're more related to lobster than they are to mosquitoes, just so as you know. But they're all related. They are generally, in their adult form and in the nymphal form, they have 8 legs, 2 body parts, and the part that looks like a head is really all about feeding apparatus. It's all mouth part. And basically, the tick that causes or carries Lyme disease and transmits it is the black-legged tick, Ixodes scapularis, in this part of the world. There are others in that family in different parts of the world that also can transmit this infection. It has 4 life stages: the egg, the larva, the nymph, and the adult. It's the adult that has been active since any mild part of the winter. The adults are active winter to early spring. The nymphal tick is becoming active now, and the nymphal tick is about the size of a poppy seed. So it is easily missed unless you are actively looking for it. The larva feeds in summertime, probably July through September. They are so tiny that people rarely see them and rarely submit them. Though, interestingly, the UMaine Tick Lab did have some larval submissions. So that always intrigues me. The good news about larva is it is almost certain that they are not carrying infection. And I almost certain. Certainly, they have been unlikely to carry Lyme disease. The one infector that can be transmitted from the egg to the larva from an infected adult female tick is Borrelia myomotoi, or hard tick relapsing fever is the disease name. It's a great name.
Ouch.
Yeah, I guess about 2% transmission from mother tick to her eggs in that one. So about 2% of larvae may be infected with that. So far, the number of cases of myomotoi disease are quite low in Maine. They remain quite low. And then the adult tick, if it does not get its it goes looking for a blood meal again in the fall. So early spring and fall, we're worried about adults. Late spring and summer, into the very earliest part of fall, it's the nymphal tick. And the nymphal tick is most responsible for human disease, in part because it is so tiny, and in part because it's most active in the seasons when we are most active with the least amount of clothing outdoors.
Right.
So.
Wow. So we know that it's the black-legged tick, but we're also seeing other ticks here in Maine these days.
Yeah. Well, yes. We have always had American dog ticks, Dermis Center ticks. They can carry certain infections. They have not been found to carry those infections so far for people in the state, at least not the ones that have been submitted to the tick lab. But they do not transmit Lyme disease. But the other tick I know you're thinking about that we're concerned about is Amblyomma americanum, or the Lone Star tick. We do not have, at this point, an established population of Lone Star ticks in the state. But this past year, 30 Lone Star ticks were submitted to the lab, and 6 of those were by individuals who had no out-of-state travel. So it's still thought that these are incidentals that were, you know, dropped off of a bird or in some other way present. But we have seen that tick expand its range, and it is certainly expanded into southern New England. So I think it is probably a time thing before it is well established in the state. Now, it does not transmit Lyme disease, but it does transmit other infections. It is capable of transmitting a disease that looks very much like Lyme, called STARI, a Southern Tick-Associated Rash Illness. Also, tularemia, a couple of viruses, and ehrlichiosis. Ehrlichiosis cases in Maine have waxed and waned. We have not had an obviously expanding number, but we're watching it. So the other fascinating thing about Lone Star ticks is that they have been associated with what you mentioned earlier, alpha-gal syndrome, which is not an infection, but is an acquired red meat allergy. It's an allergy to the sugar molecule galactose alpha 1,3 galactose, or alpha-gal. And it's a unique kind of allergy in that, in general, it is not an immediate response to the allergen, but it's a delayed response by 3 to 6 hours. So it's a hypersensitivity reaction that's delayed by 3 to 6 hours. And it's a reaction to this alpha-gal in meat. Really, all mammals have this particular moiety in their cells, except humans. So, Wow. So if we are exposed to it, we can develop an allergy to it. And the most common exposure at this point has been by tick bite by Amblyomma americanum. But there was a report from the state of Maine of an Ixodes scapularis tick associated alpha gal case.
Now that's a black-legged
tick. That's the black-legged tick.
Oh my goodness.
But let's, you know, we got to think about this a little. If it were common, we'd see a lot more alpha gal.
Do you think the person had 2 tick bites and only saw one? We don't know.
We don't know. I mean, it was really studied, and it is thought that it may not be just the Amblyomma americanum tick, not just the Lone Star tick, though that has been certainly the primary actor up to now. I think this was identified back in 2009, 2009. And obviously it existed before 2009, but that's when it became something that medicine was aware of. And if it were the tick that transmits Lyme disease as a primarily responsible tick, there'd be way more.
Okay.
So we've
talked, let's talk about, we've thrown out the names of Ehrlichiosis, and I know that there are other tick-borne diseases. Maybe you could just quickly, it doesn't have to be quickly, but just give us a sense of what these are and what we're looking for, and then, and so we have a sense if someone gets a fever in the middle of July and thinks they have the flu, maybe they don't really, or in May, or in June, or in July.
Well, you make such a good point. It's awareness. We really need to be aware of all of the possibilities for us. And the ticks that carry Lyme disease also carry, and Lyme disease is the agent of Lyme is Borrelia burgdorferi. So now you know the name. They also carry Anaplasma. Are you ready for this? Phagocytophila. And Anaplasma can cause anaplasmosis, which can be transmitted in a shorter amount of time, probably, than Borrelia can. Certainly within 24 hours. And it's a fever illness, and usually associated with headache and terrible muscle aches. So it could look very flu-like. Uncommon to have a rash, and readily treated with doxycycline. So that's the good news. Babesiosis is another agent that is transmitted by these ticks, and both Anaplasma and Babesia have growing numbers of cases and growing rates of infection in our ticks. But Babesia is a malaria-like parasite. It has to live inside of red blood cells. Anaplasma actually lives inside of white blood cells. So we can see these sometimes on a blood smear if we think to look for them. Babesiosis is an illness of fever, headache, sometimes shortness of breath, elevated liver enzymes can be associated with it. So, and they can occur together. And we talked a little bit about hard tick relapsing fever, myomotoid disease. That looks remarkably like Lyme. It is often associated with rash, fever, fatigue, a flu-like syndrome in tick season. That's one of the agents that we have to think about.
Let me just do a little business here. This is the Healthy Options Program on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman. We're speaking with Dr. Beatrice Santier about ticks and tick-borne diseases. You were going to say.
Yeah, well, I think that this is a great moment to bring up a viral infection that can be transmitted by these ticks called Powassan virus, also deer tick virus. So it's Powassan virus lineage 2 that travels in the deer tick. And Powassan virus can be transmitted by that tick within 15 minutes of attachment. So if there's a reason to try to keep ticks off of you, I think this one just percolates right up to the top as a really important time factor. Powassan virus affects the nervous system. There are probably many people who, we don't know this, who acquire the virus and are not symptomatic. But if you are symptomatic, it's a nervous system disease, and it can result in very profound disability and death. There have been fatal cases of Powassan virus in Maine. Last year, we had 6 cases of Powassan virus that we identified. So that's a pretty big deal. You know, we like to think we have 24 4 hours to get ticks off of us. But I would encourage people to keep ticks off and then take them off as soon as possible. So,
yeah, well, definitely talk about that. You said something about one of the babesiosis being a parasite. Do you treat it not with doxycycline? Do you need an antiparasitic medication or herb or something to deal with that? Or how can you even differentiate?
Well, you can differentiate it. I mean, there are tests that can be done for it. I think PCR, polymerase chain reactions, they're DNA tests, you know, tests for the genetic proteins of these creatures or any creatures. DNA is the stuff of life. So you can do tests for the DNA of Babesia and try to identify it in that way. Looking on a slide, a blood smear, you can sometimes, if there's enough of it in your blood, it can be identified within the red blood cells. But you're right, it doesn't respond to doxycycline. It does require very different treatment. The good news is Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi, Borrelia miyamotoi, and anaplasmosis, really and ehrlichiosis, all respond to doxycycline. Babesia, not so much. Typically, it needs a different approach. Azithromycin with atovaquone is one approach that's used. Clindamycin with quinine is an older approach that would still work, but is much more difficult to tolerate. And, you know, we always worry about evolving resistance in these organisms. Right. And so there are additional measures that are often taken. I think a lot of the research currently being done about treatments for Babesia include looking at agents that work for malaria, because they are related, though not closely related, organisms. And so there are some treatments that would work that can be brought over for Babesia treatment. There's a researcher at Yale who's doing really probably a lot of the best work on Babesia treatment and resistance. And Dr. Ben Mahmoud has some really fine work and good findings that will advance this science for us.
Well, so when we're talking about doxycycline, what is a course of treatment?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I think all of us are mindful of not creating resistant organisms. The topic of antibiotic stewardship is a critical discussion. We don't want to give antibiotics for things that don't respond to antibiotics. We don't want to overuse them. But stewardship really doesn't mean just not overusing. It means using the right amount to accomplish the job. And so sometimes being a bad steward means we're underusing our treatments. When you look at the early studies of treatment for Lyme disease, one of the things that comes flying through is that a 3-week course of doxycycline for Lyme disease had about a 70% rate of cure. Now, that's pretty darn good. It's not good enough, but it's pretty darn good. Individuals who a 10-day course, something less than 3 weeks, a 10-day course, had about a 60% rate of cure. And cure, eradicating symptoms, is the best we can really do for that. We can't prove cure. But the individuals in those studies, if they remained sick at the end of 3 weeks, they were immediately retreated with another 3 weeks and generally got better. So what's the right time course? Well, it's probably 3 to 6 weeks. Could we tell who was not going to be better? Well, if you had neurologic symptoms at the start, that pretty well indicates a spread illness. If you were really sick, like high fever, dramatically ill, they were probably going to need the longer course. If they had multiple rashes at the time of diagnosis, that indicates a spread disease. So all of those things make sense. And finally, of course, if they were still symptomatic at the end of treat of those 3 weeks, then they needed the longer treatment. So we do have ways to think about this that help us to get it right. There was a study out of Johns Hopkins recently that looked at ideally treated cases of erythema migrans, Lyme disease. So early Lyme disease, the erythema migrans is the rash of Lyme disease, one of the identifiables. And so, and ideal treatment was defined as 3 weeks of doxycycline. Well, it turns out that about 30% of ideally treated individuals went on to have persisting symptoms, and 11% had disabling persisting symptoms. So I think we have to look at that information and weigh it against our attempts to use shorter courses of antibiotics to treat this illness and reconsider.
It's so complicated because some people can't even tolerate doxycycline.
Right.
So we have to look at some other aspects. I know that there are some people have had success with long-term Lyme and these kinds of persistent infection with some various courses of homeopathics, but it's very specific. It's not, you know, just taking one little dose of something. It's an actual course of many months, and it's done with great care and thought in terms of that kind of thing. But I also know, and you've explained to us in the past, that if you get treated right away, then the infection or the parasite, well, not the parasite in this case, but the bacteria won't encapsulate and it can't. It's actually good to do the antibiotics right away because that's a good time to keep it from really establishing a base in your joints and your terrain. The terrain, yeah. Or is that true or is that not true?
Well,
or a thoughtful way of looking at it or not?
I think it's a way of looking at it. I think the early intervention just has been demonstrated to be best treatment. People recover if we identify it and treat it early. Not everybody, as we've identified here, about, you know, some number go on to have persisting symptoms. We do not always know what those persisting symptoms are from, whether it's the persistence of the antibiotic, a persistence of an inflammatory response, whether it is an autoimmune response to having this infection. There's a lot of work that needs to be done on folks who remain ill 6 months and more. But if you're sick immediately upon completing treatment, it makes most sense to me to treat what we still know was wrong. So I think, you know, that makes a lot of sense. The other antibiotics, and there are others, you know, amoxicillin is used, the azithromycin, clarithromycin. We have many antibiotics that can be used effectively and have studies that demonstrate their effective use for the treatment of early Lyme disease and disseminated Lyme disease. Yeah. It's once it's a persistent disease that it's more difficult to manage. Every stage of this disease is manageable. But some stages with greater difficulty. So prevention and early recognition are our level best approach.
Yes. So there, yes, we definitely, I do know many people with persistent Lyme and all of this. So I'm glad we could have this conversation, but I want to have the conversation, which we will right now, about prevention. I do want to clarify something. Can you talk about the rash and whether everybody gets a rash, what the rash looks like? And even in there's a Consumer Reports article from May, June 2026 talking about the two doses, and a lot of people read the two pills of doxy. Why is that questionable?
Well, let's talk about the rash first. The rash of Lyme disease has a name. It's called erythema migrans, and it is a uniformly red expanding rash, which sometimes clears in the center and so looks like a bullseye. But although people identify the bullseye rash with Lyme disease, that's actually quite uncommon. In the study done years ago out of Maine Med as part of the vaccine trials, only 9% of rashes of Lyme disease had a bullseye appearance. The most common appearance was, again, uniformly red and expanding. To meet CDC criteria for identification, so this is a surveillance definition to keep track of Lyme disease, it has to be 5 centimeters in size. So that's what, 2.5 inches. Does it have to be that size? Well, not for clinical work. I think if you have a person who has the possibility of exposure to these ticks and shows up with a rash with or without additional symptoms, I think you have to be very suspicious that this is Lyme disease. And sadly, the testing at that point will not help, because the testing early in disease does not show positivity in the face of infection. So you treat. If that rash is present, with the right clinical setting, the idea of an exposure possibility, it makes most sense to go ahead and treat. Does everybody get the rash? No. In fact, 15 years of surveillance data from CDC indicated that about 70% of people with Lyme disease that was a confirmed case had the rash. Now, I'm kind of a simple thinker. That means 30% did not. So do you have to have a rash to have Lyme disease? No, you do not. What might you have instead? Well, fever, body aches, terrible fatigue, headache, achy joints, light hurts your eyes. It's a list of symptoms, flu-like symptoms, with a possibility of exposure should make us very concerned that it could be Lyme disease. So,
and if you have just tuned in, you're tuned to the WERU Community Radio. This is the Healthy Options Program. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and we are discussing ticks and tick-borne diseases and illnesses with Dr. Beatrice Santier. So the people who get the one, well, they call it one dose, but it's two pills of doxy. What do we think?
Well, you know, there was a study that was done back in the late 90s that suggested that giving a single dose, those two pills of doxycycline, within 72 hours of removing a black-legged tick could prevent the rash of Lyme disease. The study may have concluded that it prevented Lyme disease, but it wasn't a fair conclusion because they did not follow this group of patients out far enough to be sure of that. So this was a 6-week follow-up, not a 3-year follow-up or a 2-year follow-up or a 1-year. This was 6 weeks. And I understand why you would choose to do that, because we know that people often get another tick bite. It tells us we're not getting the prevention education done, but people can get another tick bite. So then you have to figure out which one caused it. This is hard research to do. But the problem is, it was not preventing Lyme disease. It prevented rash at the site of the tick bite. It had a very wide, I'm going to talk statistics for a second, very wide confidence interval, which means one case either way could have changed the conclusion. So that's a problem. And it turns out that if we give an early dose of antibiotic and we do not cure the infection, we can set it up so that when you go down the road 6 weeks and draw an antibody test because someone is still sick, it's possible that we will have turned off the antibody response with the early antibiotic, and now you will have what is called seronegative Lyme disease. Well, that actually happened within this very study. So we know that it does happen. So I think as long as people understand that taking that single dose may or may not actually stop the infection, and the providers know that when this person comes back later sick and you have a negative test, that test may not be true. So,
and testing too soon is not true. And how accurate are the tests in general?
It's really a challenge. The testing system was designed to be what we call specific. That is, if you get a positive test, it is Lyme and not something else. But to get very specific, more statistics, you bring this out of me, the nerd. To get more specific, you are necessarily going to be less sensitive. And the sensitivity is the ability to pick up every case of Lyme disease. Now, that system makes sense for surveillance. And that's what it was designed for, because you want to make sure that every case that you count is, and that you're not counting things that are not. For clinical medicine, I want to make sure I find every case. So it's a challenge. The way it's designed is a very sensitive first test followed by a more specific second test. But the very sensitive first test is not sensitive enough. There was just a study released by the Lyme Biobank where they looked at this in documented cases of early Lyme. And the sensitivities could be as low as 22 to 30% in an early case. And they looked also, well, do they seroconvert? So in some instances, they had a second draw of blood, and seroconversion was uncommon. So we need a better, if we need to document it with tests, we need better tests.
Okay. So don't rely on the test. It's a clinical diagnosis.
Yeah, the test has a role. I mean, it's one data point. You've got to take the entire situation into account, the exposure possibility, the symptoms the person has, the physical signs. They may be subtle, but they are there if we look for them, and the testing when it's appropriate.
Okay. Let's talk about the all-important don't get the tick in the first place.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, this is near and dear my heart right now. I have just been doing a pretty serious review of prevention. So I'm there. And the very good news I have is that prevention works. But what prevention? What are we talking about? Well, the very first factor is awareness. Know where you are. Know where ticks are going to be. You know, for this particular tick, its habitat is the edge of the woods, even more than into the woods. So tall grass, the edge of the woods, leaf litter, that kind of vegetation, wood piles, places where rodents go because ticks, this particular one, certainly.
This is the black-legged.
The black-legged tick it feeds on rodents, and rodents hang out on wood piles. So know what you've been doing. Be aware. If you're walking on a path, stay in the middle of the path. Why not at the edge? Those kinds of things can help. Protective clothing. We sort of lightly mentioned that earlier. Light-colored clothes, because they're dark-colored ticks. They are either uniformly dark or deeply two-toned colored ticks. It'll just be easier to spot them on your clothing while you're out. And if you wear long sleeves and long pants and tuck the pants into the socks and take on that very debonair look that Maine wardens have, that's protection. These are tiny ticks, and they crawl up. They crawl away from the earth. And so they will be on the top of whatever vegetation you are passing through. If you're going through at ankle height, the tick's at your ankle. If you're going through grass that is elbow height, the tick may be at your elbow. So you just be aware of these things. And protective clothing can make a great difference. If you want to make a really great difference, permethrin-treated clothing absolutely decreases the number of tick bites people get. Shown in the lab and in real life, it just really works. If you treat the clothes yourself, you spray them till wet and then let it dry in before you wear it. That will last through several washes. If you get factory treated clothing, it will last through 70 washes.
70.
70.
But it's also toxic to cats if you're doing it yourself.
Well, when it's wet. Yeah, the wet form is cats don't have an enzyme to break it down. And so it is toxic to cats when it's in the wet form. But you should be spraying this outdoors in a well-ventilated area because the toxicity issues with it are that if you inhale it, we don't want to inhale the spray. But permethrin treatment absolutely decreases the number of tick bites. And even if you're wearing shorts and a t-shirt, sneakers and socks for your adventure, if you treat those clothes items, it decreases the tick attachments. Now, I'm a pretty simple thinker. That is if the tick starts at the bottom. What if the tick starts on your exposed skin leg? Well, then you can get more tick bites. So if in addition to using treated clothing, you use a repellent, and not just any repellent, an EPA registered repellent, you can protect yourself thoroughly from tick attachments. And that's the game here. We want to keep ticks off. DEET is still the standard. I know everybody
winces,
wants it not to be, but it really is. And it has been reviewed. You know, it was developed in the 40s, marketed in the US in the 50s. And we have a lot of safety and efficacy data on, N-diethyl metatoluamide.
Oh, my goodness. Say that three times fast, everyone. No. We've gotten very technical on this show. Other shows we've done are consumer friendly. So everyone has to go and listen to all the archives in addition to this show. But anyway.
I'll try to be good.
No, you're doing great. But it's also the dose, I mean, the percentage. One does not need to use 100%. That's really, really horribly toxic.
You know, the amount of DEET that you need to repel mosquitoes is actually very low, right? That 7 to 10% DEET actually works for mosquitoes, not for ticks. 23 to 50%, really 23 to 30% would be sufficient. Above 50% does not do more. But 23 to 30%. And read the labels, because if it is...
Yes.
More... I really went nerd on this. If you use a micro-encapsulated formula of any of the repellents, it works well and has less possibility of any absorption through the skin. The absorption through the skin is diminished. And there was an agent developed by 3M called Ultrathon, which is no longer made. But I think Sawyer, nobody's paying me to tell you these things. Sawyer has a product now that is microencapsulated. It makes it last longer and give less absorption through the skin. So look for it. Microencapsulation.
It's not one of the others that we've mentioned before from Sawyer.
Sawyer makes great products, but this is a specific one. So I think it's called like Family Friendly DEET.
Oh, okay.
Again, they are not paying me for this.
This is right. None of us are recommending.
No,
anything.
But if you can find an agent that is provided in that kind of vehicle, it works better, including some of the others, like picaridin. Picaridin is odorless, and it 20% is the concentration that is tested and effective, and it too can come microencapsulated, so I think that's really kind of excellent. The third one is IR3535, which used to be only available in Avon Skin So Soft Bug Guard Expedition formula, but there are a lot of companies that now have IR3535. It was available in Europe for 30 years before it came to the U.S. 20 years ago, so we know a lot about that now, too. Effective and protective, so you can use it on your skin, use it safely. And the key to safe use of any of these agents, wash it off after the adventure. It's just most of the difficulties have been seen with frequent high concentration applications over an extended period of time without washing it off. Wash it off. EPA registration means something these days. It means that it has been tested for safety and for efficacy. If it is not an EPA registered product, then that has not happened. And so I find the comfort of safety and efficacy really feeds the recommendations for me. Oil of lemon eucalyptus and PMD are EPA registered products. PMD is the synthetic version of oil of lemon eucalyptus. And oil of lemon eucalyptus is quite specific. It is a specific tree. It is not lemon and eucalyptus. It's lemon eucalyptus. That has been EPA registered, tested for safety and efficacy. It is not recommended below the age of 3, and the concentration that it's useful in is probably 10 to 30%, and in general, it lasts a little less time. You get a little less duration of protection from it. So just be advised. And not for ages under 3, might be just because they haven't tested it, but you can use DEET down to 2 months, so just saying.
Whoa.
Tested.
Oh my goodness.
The other category, I know everybody wants to use essential oils. I know everybody wants that. Give me a natural product. And those products, although listed, are listed under a category called 25B. They are not tested for efficacy and are presumed to be safe because they are products that could exist right around your home. And ingestion, that is eating a very small amount, is not harmful. Well, we're not going to eat it. We're going to rub it all over our skin. And so what I will just offer on that, there are a couple of articles out now. For a long time, there was no research on this. But the articles that I have been able to look through say that they may, certain of them may provide good coverage, good treatment, good repellency for the first hour and a half. And for most of them, it then falls off to nothing. So think about that. Also, think about whether reapplying puts you at risk for skin irritation and other issues. Just because it's natural doesn't mean it is harmless. So be prudent in this.
Goodness. Okay, so basil, eucalyptus, and all of that are different than lemon eucalyptus, which is, that's important to know. If you have just tuned in, this is WERU Community Radio. This is the Healthy Options Program. I'm Rhonda Fineman, and we're discussing ticks and tick-borne illness and prevention, how to keep ticks off of us with Dr. Beatrice Santier. Let's talk about tick checks.
Tick checks. Really important and actually demonstrated to be helpful in preventing Lyme disease. Full body naked tick checks when you return are critical. And that means looking, but also feeling everywhere. And what do I mean by everywhere? Behind, you know, on your feet. Now, if you're wearing shoes and socks, I'm hoping you're not going to have any ticks between your toes. But if you're out in sandals, you better check between your toes, behind the ankles, behind your knees, in the groin, at the waistband, belly button, bra line, armpits, behind your ears, in your ears, and your scalp. Look and feel everywhere. Most of these ticks are found, that's not fair. But a good number of ticks are found on the lower body, but they can be found everywhere. And think about the activity you're involved in. If you're gardening on your hands and knees, now your lower body is something very different from if you're walking or hiking, right? Now you've got to think about your hands, your arms, your whole body. So it depends on the activity, what is most at risk. And the data that we have at UMaine shows that ticks were found on every part of the body, the ticks that were submitted. So full body naked tick check, look and feel. A shower within 2 hours of your outdoor activity has been shown to wash away unattached ticks. It can also be a good opportunity for you to look and feel everywhere for ticks. So those are important elements. And as I've considered this over time, I think you should check every day for a few days after an adventure. Because if you miss it the first day, that nymphal tick is very tiny. But as it feeds, it will enlarge, and you may find it after that. Oh. So during tick season, maybe a tick check every day really is a crucial prevention strategy.
Now, what about animals, your pets bringing ticks home? Along with whatever they've caught outside.
They do like to gift us with some of their stuff, don't they? Tick check for companion animals is critical. And I would use whatever agent a veterinarian recommends for your animal, because it really is kind of a species-specific number of choices. Not every dog can take the same agents, and a number of the agents are being given orally now, that for fleas and ticks. And guess what? There is some research being done on an oral agent for people.
My goodness.
Yeah, yeah. It's a. It is. Credelia. Lotilaner is its chemical name. We're not there yet, but I can think of how many times individuals have said, "My dog can have a vaccine. My dog has an agent that keeps him off of them. How come I can't?" Well, all I can say is they're working on it. So,
okay. So, the other thing I've seen where the only time I've actually gotten a tick on me or in me is when I visited people who have pets, you know. And I was literally sitting at the dining room table, and you know. So check your couch. Check your furniture. Check.
Well, I think you really have to do a careful check and be aware that these agents that we provide our pets do cause these ticks to fall off. Now, they're usually not in very good shape when they fall off, but some ticks just travel on board in. And so your animals that are outdoors can bring ticks in for you. So be advised. I know that some folks use treated cloth blankets for their pets to lay on. I mean, you can put that in the car if you're going hiking with your dog. Have one of these treated blankets in the car when you get back. You can get those and do it yourself, or you can purchase them through some companies. Insect Shield comes to mind. They are not a sponsor. They're not paying me. But they do a good job of treating various items, clothing, dog blankets, picnic blankets, gaiters. You can get some very good
gaiters.
Good items to keep ticks off.
No, it's interesting. I was talking to someone who, as you are involved in, did a lot of research, have had long Lyme and was never diagnosed for a long time, which was terrible. But when she would go for a hike after a while, she would just be wearing light clothes and putting all the proper, permethrin of the shorts and the socks for sure, and using the skin products properly. And she would go visit her to pick her friend up, who was literally from head to toe covered in every little, you know, it was like 80 degrees out, and this woman was literally, you know, wearing two layers of permethrin clothes, and here's someone who had the whole thing going. I'm going out to have fun and I'm doing what I can do, but do we have to be in armor? I guess was the, someone was so, worried, rightly so, but then what's reasonable, I guess, is.
You know, I don't want people to be afraid. This has never been our intention because I think there is so much benefit to us from being outdoors. I'm not trying to make folks stop. I think you have to do what's comfortable for you. I'm not sure that two layers and taped at all the edges is better than awareness, appropriate permethrin treated clothing, and the thoughtful use of repellents on exposed skin. And then tick checks. And careful tick checks and prompt proper removal of the ticks. You know, if you find a tick, tweezers as close to the mouth parts as possible, so as close to the skin as possible. Steady, gentle pressure straight up, and it comes out a little bit hard because it's got a cement-like substance and barbed mouthpieces keeping it in there. Put the tick in a plastic bag, wash your hands, wash your instruments. And write down that it happened. You know, if the tick has not had any time to feed, if it's a perfectly flat tick, the likelihood of transmission is about zero.
But
if there's any evidence, if there's any evidence of feeding, then you don't know. But call your doctor, let them know what happened, and make a plan. Consult your primary care people and make plans for what you want to do about this. Yeah.
What about sending the tick in? When do you, and we talk about where are we sending it and what do we, what does that mean?
Well, a lot of folks like to have the tick tested to see what it's carrying. And what I caution folks about with this is a good plan for advancing our knowledge through the tick lab for the percentage of infected ticks, what they're carrying, where they're being found. So I think it's a great idea. Will it help us make a decision about treatment for you? No. Why? Because you're not going to have the result fast enough in the first place. The presence of the infector in the tick does not mean it was transmitted. And if you turn up sick down the road, it doesn't necessarily mean that this negative tick was the only tick you had. It was the tick you found. So I don't confuse the information we can get. On the other hand, it would be good to know what was in the tick you found. And it helps us to create maps and risk maps and try to identify what's going on in the state. So
what you're saying is you can have a tick that has whatever. And yes, right. It's a Lyme-carrying tick. Doesn't mean that you have that.
Doesn't mean it gave it to you.
Or it can come back negative from the tick lab, and it doesn't. And you can still be sick because there's ticks.
And it doesn't mean you don't have Lyme. Right.
Because there are other ticks that maybe you did not find.
Right.
All right. So well, that's, and you would send it to in Maine, and we know Amherst, and
you've got the list on the website, right, but I love the UMaine Tick Lab, I have to tell you. And if you have the ability to go online, they have forms that you can fill out so that you can send the tick to them and they will identify it for free. But if you want it tested for the DNA of the infectors, and at this point, I believe we're doing Borrelia anaplasma, Miyamotoi Borrelia, and Babesia, and I think Powassan virus. So I think it's a really good deal for $20.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know what? I think we have come to the end of another really interesting conversation about tick-borne diseases that are here in Maine, that are all over the country.
Yeah.
Wow. If you, and now I do recommend that you also check out other interviews that we've had with Dr. B. Santier, because we touch on different things each time. We get it all if you listen to more than one. But our guest today on Healthy Options has been Dr. Beatrice Santier. Thank you for being with us again on Healthy Options. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. You can find links to the show and to other information that was mentioned, as well as all of our previous interviews, as I just said, with Dr. Santier, in the Healthy Options archives of the Public Affairs section at weru.org. And also get the WERU app and find Healthy Options there. You can listen as a podcast. Thanks to Joel Mann and Amy Brown of WERU for engineering support, and to our co-producer, Petra Hall. And as always, thanks to all of our WERU listeners and supporters. This is Rhonda Feynman wishing you the best in health.